Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the current efforts to define yesterday's tragedy in San Bernardino, California, as either yet another mass shooting by well-armed, dangerous, deranged individuals, or an act of domestic terrorism, or an act of terrorism inspired from abroad. Paul Piller, the Director of Graduate Studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, who retired after 28 years in the CIA as the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, joins us to discuss what foreign influences might be involved in motivating Sayed Farouk and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, to kill 14 people, wound 21, and leave behind their six-month-old baby after dying in a furious shootout with the police. Then we'll speak with Ali Al-Ahmed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, about the need for less Saudi Wahhabi influence and more diversity in Islam, as America's imams and Islamic scholars once again find themselves on the defensive, repeating cliches that Islam is a religion of peace to an increasingly skeptical American public that is more and more susceptible to the kind of Islamophobic ignorance being spread by Republican presidential candidates like Donald Trump and Ben Carson. Then finally, we'll examine the maximum one-year jail sentence that the West Virginia coal baron Don Blankenship faces from a misdemeanor conviction of conspiracy handed down today after the Justice Department failed in a prosecution that could have led to a 30-year prison term for causing the deaths of 29 miners at the Upper Big Branch mine in 2010. Bob Kincaid, the co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and president of the Coal River Mountain Watch, joins us to explain this slap on the wrist. And joining us now is Dr. Paul Piller, who is the director of graduate studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 after a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He's the author of the books Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination, and a Bargaining Process. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Paul Piller.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And as more evidence emerges from, particularly from the police searches of the house where the two shooters in San Bernardino lived, they turned up an enormous amount of ordnance there, particularly I think about 12 pipe bombs, 4,500 rounds of ammunition, and lots of tools used in the construction of improvised explosive devices. So that combined with a U.S. intelligence official telling the Associated Press that Sayed Farouk had been in touch with extremists on social media accounts that the FBI had been monitoring, does that indicate, do you think, the possibility of foreign influence in terms of this being possibly a terrorist attack?
Well, a couple of points, Ian. One, at this stage, after an incident like this, it's always appropriate to caution that we shouldn't get ahead of the investigation. And we have the senior FBI official responsible for the investigation on the scene telling us they don't even have a motive yet. So we have to bear that in mind. And then the second thing is what we mean by influence. Influence, broadly defined, I think it's a very good possibility that, yes, there was foreign influence here. But that term encompasses a great deal with regard to inspiration, with regard to getting ideas that does not necessarily translate into anything close to organizational direction or the sorts of ties to particular groups that we would consider the classic international terrorist threat.
Well, I think the problem that we have getting our heads around is that this doesn't appear at all rational, even though it was well planned apparently, and you know, there was a lot of preparation that apparently went into it. So when you're trying to figure out motives and causes and reasons, etc., and there's no rational index here that one can find, doesn't that sort of lead you to consider perhaps things like religious fundamentalism and other influences, but that perhaps by nature aren't entirely rational?
Well, I'd caution also about the use of rationality or irrationality in this context. For the religiously motivated extremist who commits a terrorist act, there is a rationality to it, one that we wouldn't subscribe to necessarily. And indeed, when we get to issues of direct organizational connection to overseas groups, I'm not saying that was the case here, but when we do have that, it often becomes quite rational in terms of violence being used to try to pursue a larger strategy that gets involved with much more than just the incident at hand. So I think considering in rational, irrational terms at this point probably doesn't help us a lot.
Well, I suppose that's the word, the only one that comes to mind when you're trying to figure it out from a kind of Western perspective. So do you think that there is, I mean, there has been a pattern of these attacks, there's no question, and many of them have been attributed, going back to 9/11 and before then, to Al-Qaeda and now the Islamic State. So is there anything in their ideology and game plan and global strategy or whatever you want to call it that indicates any sort of similarities here?
Well, sure. And I think among the incidents we've had in this country, the one that so far, again, with the caveat that we'll find out more as the investigation goes on, the one that it reminds me of in some ways the most is the Nidal Hassan shooting at Fort Bragg. And here you can ask the question in each of these cases, what was the choice of target showing? Here in the San Bernardino incident, it was a bunch of coworkers with this holiday party. In the case of the Hassan shooting at Fort Bragg, it was people at a medical clinic on the post. I think in both of those cases, and in the case of Hassan, of course, as we know, he was in close contact, well, not close contact, but he was in contact with Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula. There was a clear inspiration with regard to a known foreign terrorist group. But the choice of victims, choice of targets, was probably more a matter of operational opportunity, someplace to which the gunman had access, and where he knew there would be a significant number of people gathered who could be killed in one operation. And maybe that's why this target was selected in the case of the San Bernardino shooting, that it did have much more to do with foreign ideologies and whatever contacts the shooter had in Saudi Arabia than it did with whatever frictions he may have had with his coworkers in the county authority where he worked.
So that's, I guess, what people have been wrestling with. Is it about going postal or is it about killing infidels? But again, I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Piller, who is the Director of Graduate Studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He's the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process. And in terms of trying to get a handle on this, the ideological underpinning, I mean, one of the things that we're engaged in, we seem to be in terms of both the reality in terms of the Islamic State's activities in Syria and Iraq, and the coalition's, Western coalition's response to it, seems largely based upon the idea that through air power, somehow we can contain and degrade. And now the British, the French, and the Germans are sort of joining in as a result of what happened in Paris. But you get the feeling there's a sort of element of futility in the idea that you can bomb an idea into submission or an ideology into submission. So I was very struck by a recent op-ed in the New York Times by a French Islamic scholar making the connections between the ideology of basically making the case that the Saudi Wahhabi regime is the ISIS that has succeeded. Now, that's notwithstanding that al-Baghdadi wants to be the new caliph and essentially take over Mecca and Medina. But that's pretty much what happened about 150 years ago when the Wahhabis came out of the desert. And is there any possibility that these characters in Toyota pickup trucks like a, you know, Mad Max convoy could ever take over the holy shrines?
There's always a possibility. I think that's very unlikely. I mean, when we're talking about Saudi Arabia, yes, there is, of course, the old bargain that the Al Saud had reached with the Wahhabis continues to be a basis for political power in the kingdom today, and it's been a matter of various bargains that continue to be struck between the ulama, the clerics, who have particular concern over things like social mores and education, and have been given a lot of license in that regard to set the tone in Saudi Arabia, in return for which the Saud family has continued to be supported in power in a regime that is, of course, highly undemocratic, almost medieval in its political structure. That said, we have to draw a distinction here. I think it does go somewhat too far to say that Saudi Arabia today is sort of the other ISIS, the other Daesh. The status of women, for example, is still very much a subordinate one in Saudi Arabia. They are not allowed to drive and so on, but they aren't a bunch of sex slaves as they are in the ISIS mini state. And we could go on and on with regard to, you know, the degrees of brutality that are involved here. Nonetheless, the underlying point that there are certain ways, intolerant ways of looking at the world, and at the outside world, that have been associated with the Wahhabi, not a name they apply to themselves, by the way, brand of Islam that has been the underpinning for the Saudi regime, that does start one, or could start one, on the course of taking a more militant and violent approach toward pursuing that kind of ideology. So those who draw this connection, I think, have a valid connection, as long as we keep in mind still the important differences.
But given that we apparently don't have a lot, I mean, I'm not sure what the intelligence is on how Saudi Arabia operates, but my understanding is, for example, in all the high-level meetings, notes aren't taken. And that, do we really know the status of this enduring compact between the Al Sauds and the ulama, the religious authorities? I mean, is it possible that the religious authorities could sort of turn one day and say to ISIS or Daesh, "Come on in, brothers." I mean, how do you measure this, the health of this compact, for the want of a better description?
Well, there's not going to be the "come in, brothers" scenario, in that the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia sees Daesh or ISIS as a threat to themselves, just as the Saudi regime does.
I see.
These are not partners; they are
rivals.
Yeah. Yes. And indeed, you know, for both the Saudi regime and for the clerical establishment in Saudi Arabia, anybody who claims to put forth a new political and social order based on the Islamic religion is competition for them. It's why they've had the great falling out they've had with the Muslim Brotherhood based in Egypt. Although previously they had a relationship with a lot of Egyptian Muslim brothers in Saudi Arabia, they are very much rivals and adversaries today. So no, that scenario is not going to happen. I think the greater worries about Saudi Arabia have to do more just with the pent up demand among many ordinary Saudis for having more of a stake in their own political system, their own economy, and their own society beyond the what they have right now, which is a kind of state centered largesse And again, a highly undemocratic system that really belongs in the Middle Ages and not sure. the 21st century.
Well, just in the last minute then, surely the Saudis can do more than to distance themselves from Daesh and to stake out a better position in terms of prior support, still lingering ambiguities about 9/11 and the Saudi involvement. Isn't there some clarifications that they could offer so that we wouldn't be having these conversations?
Well, the main current policy problem with regard to Saudi Arabia and with regard to ISIS are the Saudi hang-ups with regard to other issues in Syria and their determination to get rid of the Assad regime, which they consider an objective more important than most of what can be done against Daesh or ISIS. So that's been the huge complication for us and for the other powers concerned about Syria, and Syria is where the main action is right now with regard to trying to do something about ISIS.
Well, Dr. Paul Piller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Paul Piller, who's the Director of Graduate Studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. And he's the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into whether there is a need for less Saudi Wahhabism and more diversity in Islam, as American imams and Islamic scholars once again find themselves on the defensive. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, who is the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And it seems to me that in terms of the two shooters, Syed Rizwan Farooq and his wife, Tafshin Malik, that there are some Wahhabi fingerprints beginning to emerge on their background. And in many ways, it's what happened is so incomprehensible that one has to assume that somehow these two sort of woke up yesterday morning and decided yesterday was a day to be martyred. I mean, to me, that's the only thing that makes any sense.
Absolutely. I think in many terrorist attacks, we see the word Saudi come up in many ways. It was not only September 11, but if you look at many terrorist attacks around the world, there is some Saudi connection to it, as they say. All the terror roads lead to Saudi Arabia. And this is unfortunate because you see a lot of Muslims taking Saudi Arabia as a model. And because of the Saudi government religious, official religious policy, or the official religion is Wahhabi Islam, which tends to be extreme, advocating violence against the other, be it a Muslim or not a Muslim, especially non-Muslim. So that is really a product of that the Saudi government continues to enforce and spread that small form of Islam or interpretation of Islam across the globe. And it's not only in Indonesia, but also in Los Angeles, in Washington, in Paris, and other countries. And that's why I think this is an issue that must be seriously and honestly discussed by the American policymakers.
So specifically, though, in terms of Farouk and Malik, the couple who died yesterday after killing 14 people and wounding 21 others, Farouk went to Saudi Arabia in 2013 for the Hajj, where he met Malik, a native of Pakistan. He's American-born of Pakistani parents. She's apparently was a pharmacist and came here to the United States on a fiancé visa. So what are the actual... Because the father of Sayyid Farouk has indicated that his son, after visiting Saudi Arabia, became incredibly religious and strict and grew a beard, and those are all of the outward trappings, if you will, of Wahhabism.
Yeah, well, you know, there are a lot of Muslims who are religious, but the difference here is what type, what kind. It really has to do with the mindset. Like you indicated, going to Saudi Arabia created this monster. Or monstrous thinking, and maybe his wife, having lived there, let's not forget the wife, having lived there and absorbed that ideology, even maybe at a deeper level, she influenced her husband. So, I mean, I'm assuming here from experience that the wife had also played a role, and given the fact that she doesn't work, that means she doesn't want to mix with this environment, and she has no photos. We don't even see a photo of her yet, because that's a reflection of what type of an ideology that she has. Let us remember, in 2004, a young American boy who was recruited to Saudi Arabia by the Saudi government, Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, young, bright student, went to the Saudi school here and was the valedictorian and then recruited by something called the Islamic or the Institute for Islamic and Arabic Sciences in America, another Saudi outfit in Washington, to Saudi Arabia to become a religious cleric, and he ended up conspiring to kill President George W. Bush at the time. So that gives you a window in the way people who travel to Saudi Arabia are converted. And Saudi Arabia has an elaborate programs to convert Muslims from basically whatever they are. They are traditional Sunni Muslims or Shia Muslims or whatever, Sufi Muslims, into their own specific narrow-minded Wahhabi interpretation of Islam. That really, that is what happens. You see that happen many times where an ordinary Muslim lives his life but converts to Wahhabi Islam and suddenly becomes this dangerous person who could turn to a terrorist any day. And I think that is the issue that must be discussed today. This is an issue of ideology that must be addressed. It should not be ignored.
Well, obviously, we don't know, you know, facts or backgrounds are starting to be delved into now, although apparently the FBI did, to some extent, have Sayyid Rizwan Farouk on their radar because he had communicated by phone and social media with people that the FBI were watching. How much do you know in terms of this possible Wahhabi connection, which seems to be, as I say, the most logical explanation so far?
Well, there is, you know, an influence that's coming out of, there is a source of that influence. People don't just go blindly and follow people. They have an address that they go to. And that address usually comes to Saudi Arabia, to Saudi government and pro-government clerics who encourage. I mean, I have in my office here, for example, a book issued by the Saudi government. This is in Arabic for Saudi students who are coming here to study. And it teaches them to hate Christians and Jews and not to mix with them and to deal with them in a harsh manner. And you know, the Saudi government religious authority encourages its followers to really have animosity with every other religion or culture or faith. And that is what they teach those adherents and the people who they recruit. So there is a direct connection between what Mr. Farouk and his wife learned from the Saudi sources on social media and their action. You notice that there are no other Muslim group, because these people are Muslim, yes, but they are part of a certain branch of Islam. And that's not the majority of the Muslims. And they are the only one who carry such actions. You might not like other Muslims, but you don't see other adherents of other interpretation of Islam carry on such actions. The interpretation of Islam followed by the attackers of September 11, the attackers of Paris attacks, the attackers of San Bernardino is the same. That is the problem. That is where we need to focus on.
Well, but the Saudi money has a big influence on American Islam. You know, there's a Saudi-funded mosque here in Los Angeles in Culver City. And, you know, through the Saudi intelligence, through these various big foundation charities and the individuals that are very wealthy, like the bin Ladens and others, it's very difficult. There are lots, all kinds of cutouts in terms of where the money comes from. But a lot of money has been spread around. And I'm wondering the extent to which it has trapped a lot of Islamic scholars and imams into a kind of double talk, because every time these things happen, you hear the refrain, Islam is a religion of peace. And at a certain point, it's not going to cut it. And already, you know, you've got these horrible Islamophobes on the right wing jumping all over this stuff. So unless the Islamic clerics come forth in a credible way and start talking about what has happened to their religion and the direction it's taken under the influence of the Saudis who control the holy shrines, it seems to me that we're just going to go on with this denial.
Absolutely. I think the money plays a huge part in the silence that many Muslim organizations in the United States. And I was horrified to see CARE, for example, yesterday have a press conference on this, because it was like, you know, admitting guilt to something that they didn't have to. Putting the word Islam in this attack really is not the best thing you can do at this moment. The problem is now the Saudi government controls the most important Islamic assets in Mecca and Medina. And also they have the most important oil resources in the world. This combination has created a monster where 50 or 60 years ago, the center of Islamic guidance for the Sunni Muslims it was in Cairo, was in Al-Azhar, the ancient seat of learning for Muslims, so which is much more progressive, way more progressive than the Saudi. So what we're seeing here, we have a regression, because now Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the most extreme interpretation of Islam, are guiding the majority or a large major, you know, portion of the Muslim communities around the world. And that relationship, that influence, is creating the extremism and terrorism. So we really, if we are trying to solve this problem, we need to return the guidance center to the places where Islam moved forward, where Islam actually, even in its early stage, flourished in Iraq, Syria, and Egypt, not in the Arabian Peninsula. It was born in the Arabian Peninsula. But when it comes to the schools of thoughts, philosophy, authoring books, and Arabic language even, was created in Basra in Iraq, and in Damascus, and in Cairo. And these are the places we need to return to find, to promote an Islam that is forward-thinking, not an Islam that is regressive, that's extreme. And like, you know, everybody knows that religion is what you make of it. And in the Gulf, it's not the religion that anybody wants. Most Muslims, I can guarantee, they do not agree to this. But there is a powerful government that is supported, honestly, by the United States and other Western governments to promote such an ideology.
Well, I think a lot of people are having a hard time understanding, and perhaps there's no way to understand this, why this couple would have dropped off their six-month-old child to the grandmother's house and said that they had medical appointments, and then went on to carry out this massacre. And also why, my understanding is not consistent with Wahhabi teachings for a woman to engage in a gun battle like the wife did. So, and to martyr herself along with her husband, that seems a little unusual, it's not even for Wahhabis.
No, it's not. It's really not. That's something that they, the problem is the way they think is, there is something that promoted and aggressively in the Wahhabi teaching is that we are at war. We are in active war with the enemy, and that enemy is the Christians, the Jews. So there is, in their mindset, two type of military or violent jihad. There is the defensive type and there is the aggressive type. So right now we are in the defensive stage. So a part of the defensive stage, everybody can participate, and women, children, without even the permission or notification of their guardians. So it's not consistent with the teaching. It is consistent with that because they view this as a defensive, protecting Islam in their view from the enemy, that the United States and Christians of this country.
So what do you think happened here? Because the indications were, even yesterday, and they certainly been borne out, that this was well planned, and the way that they were dressed and all the ammunition and stuff they had. And of course, we live in a crazy country where anybody can buy assault weapons just about, and we have the best armed terrorists and we have the best armed criminals, and you have this crazy thing where you've got a no-fly list for suspected terrorists in the United States, but they're free to buy guns thanks to the NRA. So that's obviously a huge loophole that can be exploited. But I'm trying to understand the guidance here. If you are to accept the idea that this fellow was indoctrinated in Saudi Arabia and married his wife in Saudi Arabia and then came back over here and they lived this abstemious kind of life, and apparently he cut off all of his friends, and his father said he became quite remote and fanatical. So how do you understand that progression in terms of the thought process? What, it's not as if you get marching orders, go back to America and kill Americans, right? That's not how it works.
No, it's not necessarily that way. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But in my profile of the 9/11 hijackers, the Saudi, what I noticed was one thing. People lived either a normal life or kind of a life on the other extreme. And that's the case with the Paris bombers as well, that they lived, for example, in Saudi Arabia, one of the hijackers was, this is according to Saudi standards, obviously, that he was a homosexual and he played the instrument. Then he entered what they call the repentance test, where he said, this is evil, I shouldn't have done this, I shouldn't play music or have sex with boys. And then he joined Al-Qaeda, and he became one of the September 11 hijackers. There's always this sort of dark side, skeletons in their life, and then when they repent, they have this the convert zealousy. They want to make up for their past mistakes, and they want to wash their dirty laundry by committing such an act, because in their mind they are going to heaven. This is the fastest way to cleanse your yourself from all the sins you have committed, and that I think that drove them to commit this. And notice that it's not only the husband but the wife. So this was a two-team operation. She accepted that, and I think she was already in that mindset. And it's really about a mindset. When you grow with a certain mentality, or when you taught a certain mentality, you believe that you your life is worth everything, and the other life is worth nothing. This is exactly what Wahhabi Islam or interpretation of Islam through the Wahhabi gate is. It does not consider Muslims, the rest of the Muslims, to be original Muslims, and of course the rest of the religions as well. So that's the problem, and I think to solve this problem, we need to force the Saudi government and the Qatari government to become inclusive, to allow other Muslim voices in their country to have power, to share power, so they don't think that they are the only true path to God. And I think that is really the best way to stop terrorism, is by forcing this multiplication or pluralism within those countries. from religious point standpoint.
Sure.
And political standpoint.
Well, there's certainly, you know, when you've got France, Germany and the UK lining up to bomb Daesh, the Islamic State in Syria, as though you can bomb ISIS and Wahhabism out of existence. You can't kill an idea with bombs. You have to kill an idea and an ideology with a better idea and a better ideology, surely. And you've just given an example that if there were more religious diversity allowed in Saudi Arabia, as there was before the Wahhabis took over, by the way, you know, and of course, who are the first people that the Wahhabis go after? The Sufis, you know, the ones that enjoy life and have a good time, you know.
That's true. You know, when the Wahhabi grew in the 18th century, it attacked Sunni Muslims, if not even Sufis, Sunni Muslims. They call them all kind of things like apostates or polytheists. Bombs maybe do part of the work, but a small part of it. It has to do with changing the environment. And the environment you can change through your political or soft power, your political and economic power, to force these governments to accept other forms of Islam you don't have to import it. It's there already in Saudi Arabia. I've written this in the year 2000, believe it or not, and I said that the number one victim of Saudi government religious policy and religious restriction is the Sunni, the largest three leading Sunni schools of Islam, the Hanafi, the Maliki, and the Shafi'i, which are none of these terrorists adheres to. So if the United States and Europe was pushing to have these schools remain alive, and we would see a balance between these Sunni schools and the Saudi version of Islam, I think most people in that country would have adhered to the Sunni Islam, because people naturally like easy things, things that doesn't put them at odds with other people. But because in Saudi Arabia it is enforced upon the population, and you cannot get a job, you cannot be a judge, for example, if you are not a Wahhabi. You cannot get a lot of jobs if you are a Sufi. If you are a Shia, obviously, you cannot even be a mayor. So people, to survive, they had to adhere to this ideology. And without forcing that diversity within that country, and religious diversity and political diversity, we will continue to have this problem.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ali Alamed.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into the slap on the wrist sentencing of the West Virginia coal baron, Don Blankenship. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bob Kincaid, who's the co-founder of the Appalachians Communities Health Emergency Campaign, president of Coal River Mountain Watch, and founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he is a regular host. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Kincaid.
Thank you very kindly, Ian.
And the fact that Donald Blankenship is facing a possible 1 year in jail, which is the maximum sentence that he's now exposed to, doesn't strike me as a great victory for the Justice Department, which had originally pursued a prosecution that was supposed to lead to Blankenship doing a 30-year prison term. So I guess you're there in the neighborhood, and you've been following this Blankenship for years. What's your response to the verdict?
If it's not much of a victory for the Justice Department, it's even less of a victory for the people of Appalachia, and even still less of a victory for the families of 29 people incinerated past recognition as human beings in Don Blankenship's Upper Big Branch mine, Ian. It is near enough nothing to qualify as nothing. And in point of fact, it's really as much as many of us even dared to suspect might happen.
So what went wrong? Did the Justice Department drop the ball, or is this about just money and how much money can overwhelm justice?
This is a case, Ian, in which we find out that the justice system in the United States is not in any wise designed to mete out any sort of criminal justice to people from the CEO, so-called ownership class. This transcends boundaries of regions or states, and people far, far outside West Virginia can take a look at this and learn an important lesson. When you look at what he was convicted of, the victory, so to speak, bear in mind that a conspiracy which results in the violation of regulations which are designed to keep disasters from happening inside a particular industry, the conspiracy to evade those regulations in the eyes of the Congress of the United States only counts as a misdemeanor. A misdemeanor like petty larceny or shoplifting, or it's a tiny crime. The working people of the United States who rely upon their government to help keep them safe from the avaricious grasping of the CEO class and the Wall Street class have next to no protections whatsoever. This would have been the same had it been a coal baron like Don Blankenship, or say, a Monsanto executive, or any other executive class member who likes to get around regulations in order to maximize profits. This is living proof, Ian, that profits matter in the United States of America far more than do people and always have.
And in terms of profits for Mr. Blankenship personally, he was paid about $18 million a year by his company, right?
That seems about the right number.
And it's a multi-billion-dollar company. And
well, it was. It's in bankruptcy now.
Yeah, yeah. No. Well, I suppose there's something to be taken from that. But there's just no sense that this is a guy that captured the patriotic high ground. He had that sort of John Wayne stance that I'm a real American. He had American flags festooned all over him. He's suspenders, etc. Has any of the swagger gone away if his company's now bankrupt? What's your sense of what happened today in being handed down this slap on the wrist?
This isn't even going to count as a blip on his radar. First of all, if he ever actually sees the inside of a prison, it's going to be one of those things that we recognize as club fed. He isn't going to Leavenworth, Ian. He will serve some portion of 1 year, but that's as much as he can serve, and he'll serve it raking leaves at an Air Force Base federal complex or something similar. Maybe the federal facility down in Ashland, where former governor of West Virginia Arch Moore, the biggest crook who's ever occupied that office, went for a time after he turned out to be a bag man for the coal industry.
Well, it does seem that already the signals are that they're going to go light on him, because the judge was asked not to grant him bail and to keep him under house arrest, but he was free to walk, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, they're already talking about how he's going to appeal the conviction. So the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond will likely get a look at this case.
And what do you expect from them? Are they friendly to coal barons?
I think the entire federal judiciary is friendly toward the toward the moneyed interests. It's been my long opinion that the law in this country exists to, above all, protect the money. And Don Blankenship represents some of the money that will be protected.
And again, I'm speaking with Bob Kincaid, who is a co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the president of the Coal River Mountain Watch and founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he's a regular host. And we're talking about the verdict today in terms of a one-year sentence, or the maximum of one-year sentence, for Don Blankenship, the head of Massey Energy, who was the CEO and most people consider to be largely responsible for the deaths of 29 workers who were killed in the Upper Big Branch mine in 2010. And essentially, they got him on some sort of paperwork, minor charge on false statements and securities fraud, right? Nothing to do with the deaths of 29 miners. And
the deaths of 29 miners had absolutely nothing to do with this trial, and people need to understand that, Ian. But more particularly, he was let go on the securities fraud counts and was convicted on one count of conspiring to evade Mine Safety and Health Administration regulations, which is why I said that we need to take into account the fact that violating regulations that can lead to people dying is only a misdemeanor in the eyes of the federal government. By the same token, however, it is reminiscent of nothing if not the fact that Al Capone was never taken down for any of the many murders that he was behind. Al Capone was taken down for tax evasion. This is almost a direct, 70, 80, 90-year analog.
Right, but it doesn't measure up to at least Capone. They gave him a stiff sentence and he died in prison, didn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. That part of it does not measure up. And if there's anything to be learned out of this, is that if we had a responsive Congress in this country, which is a ridiculous statement on its face given the current composition of the Congress, maybe we would have some safety regulations and criminal penalties for the violation thereof that would equate human lives and the ending of them with felonious conduct.
Well,
again, this is just a misdemeanor. This is like jaywalking.
Sure. Well, but Bob Kincaid, this Congress that you're talking about, while the President of the United States is in Paris trying to lead the world in dealing with climate change and global warming, what does this Congress do? It starts to undo his rather modest clean energy proposals to cut back on coal-fired plants and switch to natural gas-fired plants, etc. The coal-fired plants are the low-hanging fruit in terms of what you can do about CO2 emissions, in a very immediate sense. It's going to take a while to switch every car over to hybrids and electric, but these things can be done. They should be done. Here he is, the president's trying to lead the world, and back at home, they try and cut the rug out from under him and undo what modest advances that he's proposing already.
Absolutely, absolutely. This Congress is a wholly owned subsidiary of the hydrocarbon energy industry sector. I mean, let's take into account with regard to Don Blankenship one other thing, Ian, and that is this. The coal that Don Blankenship's corporation mined, Massey, and then Alpha Natural Resources after they bought him out, that coal, the extraction of it in Appalachia, poisoned countless numbers of individuals who had to breathe the toxic blasting dust fallout from his mountaintop removal operations. One. Two, when that coal was burned in various and sundry power plants in order to turn the coal into electricity, I may be wrong on the number, but I've read that something like 40,000, there are 40,000 excess deaths in the United States every year from people breathing the particulates that come from coal-fired power plants. So this industry is death from start to finish. And this what Don Blankenship did is only something similar to things that other coal barons do and have done throughout Appalachia for over 100 years. 71% of the human beings incinerated past recognition as such at Upper Big Branch, 71% of those men, Ian, had evidence in their bodies of black lung disease, a disease which is entirely preventable inside an underground mining environment. It also shows up now in miners who work in mountaintop removal surface mining sites. Three people a day, nearly 1,000 a year, still die from black lung. Again, a preventable industrial disease. Don Blankenship has blood not only on his hands, but over his ankles, over his shoe tops, up past his knees, and simmering about his chin. And so does the entire coal industry. And we got to remember that as a sort of takeaway from all of this.
Well, I don't know whether you were in the courthouse, Bob Kincaid, but descriptions that I've seen and read were of the relatives of the dead miners. They were all apparently down in the front row of the courthouse, you know, trembling with anticipation, their heads bowed in silent prayer. And when they read the verdict, you know, one woman gasps, but the general sense was the son of a bitch got away with it.
And he did, just like coal barons have for over 100 years, Ian. The history of West Virginia is a history of mass murder. Places like Monongah and Farmington and Eccles and these are places, and you know, we're near the Christmas season. It's worth remembering, I think, 1907, Monongah, when over 300 people died, most of them immigrants, 300 people died in an explosion there. And when they finally doled out a tiny little dab of money to the widows and the orphans, one coal executive was heard to say, "Well, this will make a pretty nice Christmas for them people."
So how do you explain, though, that kind of class difference in Appalachia and in the United States, which is supposedly nominally an egalitarian society? How do you have this amazing gulf between these coal barons and the miners? And why is it that they are so arrogant and dismissive of human life? They don't seem to, they seem to place themselves above, not just in a class sense, but almost in terms of humanity itself. They don't treat their workers as fellow human beings.
Because they are above it, Ian. This is a matter of not class so much as economics. If an industry can capture a government, then the industry can do as it wishes. And that's been the case in Appalachia and in places like West Virginia. This state was born in 1863 amid the bloodshed of the Civil War, and it has been almost always the case here. Coal companies can come in, purchase the government, and the government that was bought then has stayed bought until now. Our state is in a matter of free fall, even as we speak, as the coal industry dies in Appalachia. It isn't all gone. It isn't over by any stretch of the imagination, but there's no good, no net good to the people of this state by the time you factor in the death and the maimings and the misery and the poison. There's no good, and there is no accountability because that industry has been able to purchase the government. It's government for sale to the highest bidder, and some guy on a mine site or somebody living below one and breathing the poisons does not have the ability to bid against an entire multi-billion-dollar industry.
But when you say this is a mining industry that's bought a government, which is pretty clearly the case, this is a government that was recently, we're talking about the Republican government, the Republican Senate, and the Republican House, recently made gains in West Virginia, when a Democratic senator retired, a Republican replaced him, or I think a Republican governor won, did they not?
Yes. I mean, well, no, so, the governor's not a Republican yet.
Might
as well be one that isn't one.
But the senator, the woman that replaced Rockefeller.
Yeah, Shelley Moore Capito, the daughter of the man I referred to earlier as the single most crooked individual ever to inhabit the office of governor of West Virginia, yes.
So she got reelected. So explain that then. You've got people being hosed by these coal barons who treat them like animals with total contempt. And yet, how do you explain the state, these constituents, voting against their interests to the extent that they appear to have done?
Well, it's not so much, Ian, that they're voting against their interests. It's that we don't understand what their interests are. If you take an electorate and you deliberately defeat any idea of meaningful education, and you make sure that the economy is a mono economy, and you then and you're of course always very supportive of the particular brand of evangelical fundamentalist religion that has hold around here, then you can move in and you can tell people that those liberals are going to come and make you stop loving Jesus, but that the Republicans love Jesus. And that's their interest, Ian. They've never had some... We in Appalachia, we hillbillies, and I am one, okay? I'm 9 generations of family here. We've never had much. It's not like we had something and then it was taken away. We've never had much at all. My grandfather worked for... something called scrip, fake money that could only be spent at the company store. He didn't work for real American money, and he wasn't paid in real American money. Okay? So what we have and what we have had is some sort of faith in a better afterlife where the coal bosses won't be murdering us and some way to get through this veil of tears. We are, after all, largely a Scots-Irish population here. We came from hard circumstances into hard circumstances, and hard circumstances are all we have ever known. So and because we are poorly educated, in large part, because we always seem to have whatever we have taken away from us, when somebody comes along and says, those liberals are going to get your Jesus. Well, we will run, not walk, not crawl, but run to the polls to make sure that the one thing we still have, we get to keep. There's a great line from John Sayles' brilliant 1980s film, Mate One, in which the coal organizer says, "All we got in common is our misery, so the least we can do is share it." That's us, Ian. That's us.
Well, Bob Kincaid, I thank you so much for joining us. It's a heartbreaking story, and I wish there was more justice in the land, but I guess we've all got to fight for it and keep fighting.
Mother Jones, Mary Harris Jones, once said, Ian, pray for the dead, fight like hell for the living. That's what I intend to do.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Bob.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Bob Kincaid, who's a co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and president of the Coal River Mountain Watch and founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he's a regular host. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast and contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.